I want to welcome everybody to another episode of 2 Men in a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle, and I've kind of got a giggle in my voice now, Bob. You know, our podcast is actually hitting people.
Good. It hits us.
It hits me.
It's therapeutic.
For sure, and I hope it does the same thing for our listeners that it does for us, you know. We go through every day just like everybody else does. It's not all roses and,
yeah,
you know, pomp. You know, it's not all pomp and circumstance. It's work.
Yeah.
And it's really when we I want to say devote, Bob, but I don't know if that's the right word.
Well, you know what? Let me try to picture what I know you're saying, because we had a conversation before we began our podcast, but. You know, imagine the tabernacle, or what we will read in later books of the Bible, the temple, mm-hmm. and you're approaching that. Mm-hmm. And you know that you are metaphorically dirty from the world. You're
unclean. Can't go in.
And you're going into a thing that's clean. And so each step you take, you're getting closer and closer, and you take steps internally in your heart, and then there are external mechanical things that you accomplish. And when we come to the podcast, it's like that. It's like we sit down with the gunk of the world still on us, and yet as you begin to read God's words and think about them, you feel cleaner and cleaner as you go along.
I agree, Bob, and you know, I hope that does the same thing for our listeners. You know, when you really focus your gaze on God, things change.
Yeah.
Everything changes.
That's right. Well, how about if we do that, and we're in Leviticus chapter 26, and how about if we read the first 13 verses?
Okay.
And then pause. So here's Leviticus chapter 26, verse 1. You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and the grape gathering lasts until sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I shall also grant peace in the land, so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword shall pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So I will turn toward you, make you fruitful, and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, so that you would not be their slaves. And I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. So let's pause there. So how's it going to go if they do what God's saying?
Well, how's it going to go if we go back to verse 4, chapter 26, verse 4? Then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce, and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. There's never a blip.
Yeah,
that's what I hear.
No enemy can threaten you.
Nobody.
5 of you guys will run off 100.
Right. There's not a blip here. But if you believe in God and you put it in His hands, is that what He's saying? That's yep. what I very
you do what I'm telling you to do, and it'll go just right.
If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall.
Yeah, and you know, some of the phrases are so poignant that he uses. For instance, when he says, I will turn to you and my soul will not reject you, like verse 11. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you and my soul will not reject you. I mean, he's just describing, you know, a loving embrace. You guys do what I'm telling you, and we're going to be so tight, and everything's going to go great.
Well, let's go back to plan A, Bob.
Yeah, that's right.
Wasn't plan A, and that hasn't changed up till this point, wasn't plan A that God and man
were together? Yeah, and they're going to rule. We're going to rule this garden, and you guys, you know, expand, multiply, take over the whole thing. And so now he's describing setting them free from Egypt and taking them to the land of Canaan. And you guys do what I'm telling you, it's going to be bad. It's going to be plan A. It's going to come to fruition. We're going to take over this whole thing and rule it peacefully.
Well, and really, Bob, you know, that's something that has been a big rock for me to understand. Was that plan A was God and man together.
That's right.
I didn't really get that in my whole life until I really started reading the Word. But when you read what we just heard, he's reiterating that again.
All the time, yeah. Yeah, he doesn't lose sight of the goal. So now let's embark on a longer section, and I emphasize that for a reason.
Oh, yeah, okay. It is.
So we'll start in verse 14 of chapter 26. But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. I'll appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption and fever that shall waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you shall sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies shall eat it up. I will set my face against you so that you shall be struck down before your enemies, and those who hate you shall rule over you. You shall flee when no one is pursuing you. If also after these things you do not obey me, so like after round one,
right,
you're still not on board. If also after these things you do not obey me, then I'll punish you seven times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride of power. I will also make your sky like iron, your earth like bronze. Let's pause this quickly. What's he saying? Sky like iron, earth like bronze.
No idea.
No rain. He's saying no rain.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Verse 20, your strength shall be spent uselessly, for your land shall not yield its produce, and the trees of the land shall not yield their fruit. Well, because they don't have any water. If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which shall bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your numbers so that your roads lie deserted. And if by these things you are not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you, and I, even I, will strike you seven times for your sins. I will also bring upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. And when you gather together into your cities, I will send pestilence among you, so that you shall be delivered into enemy hands. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts, so that you will eat and not be satisfied. Yet, if in spite of this you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I'll act with wrathful hostility against you. And I, even I, will punish you 7 times for your sins. Further, you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters you shall eat. I then will destroy your high places, and cut down your incense altars, and heap your remains on the remains of your idols. For my soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities as well, and will make your sanctuaries desolate. And I will not smell your soothing aromas. And I will make the land desolate, so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations, and will draw out a sword after you, as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths, all the days of the desolation, while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you're living on it. As for those of you who may be left, I will also bring weakness into their hearts in the lands of their enemies, and the sound of a driven leaf will chase them. Even when no one is pursuing, they will flee as though from the sword, and they will fall. They will therefore stumble over each other, as if running from the sword, although no one is pursuing, and you will have no strength to stand up before your enemies. But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' land will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and also because of the iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them. If they confess their iniquity and iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness which they committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me, I also was acting with hostility against them to bring them into the land of their enemies. Or if their uncircumcised heart becomes humbled so that they then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob. And I'll remember also my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham as well. And I will remember the land. For the land shall be abandoned by them and shall make up for its Sabbaths while it's made desolate without them. They meanwhile shall be making amends for their iniquity because they rejected my ordinances and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them. Nor will I so abhor them as to destroy them, breaking my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt, in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and ordinances and laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses at Mount Sinai. So, does that put the fear of God in you? You know, like if you don't,
Well, here's what I was going to bring up, Bob. I'm going to start in verse 15. If instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments, and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. So here's, you know, and I may be totally off base here, Bob, but here's kind of what I hear here. You know, as I'm out in the world and I'm talking to people, so many times I hear people say, well, my God is like this, and my God is like that.
Mm-hmm.
And many times I find out that their God is exactly like them.
That's right.
Our God is not.
You know, let's say it like this.
Okay, go ahead.
He's not just our God. He's
the
one
God.
And only God.
The God.
He's not an enabler.
Mm-mm.
He's not a parent that you can goof off forever and he's going to just let you go your way. He will pursue you. He will discipline you, and it's out of love. I mean, this is, I mean, tell you a weird application of this, but there are things, I want to truly set this before our listeners. There are things that often are hard for us to put into words, but they're in our guts. You know, we act on them on such a primal level. I remember the only time growing up that I cried was when my dad spanked me one time. And it was, you know, he told me, you know, don't play with fire. And I went outside and took this plastic tire off this Tonka toy and lit it on fire so I could drop the sizzling goo on an ant hive and watch it just burn up the ants. It was so cool. Well, I was so enraptured by the destruction I was wreaking that I didn't realize it was starting to burn me, and it melted to my hand and glued my fingers together. I mean, it was pretty gnarly. So when I came home, you know, my mom was all, oh, she's trying to nurse me. And my dad came home and, didn't I tell you not to play with fire? You know, you're just staring at him like, of course you told me that, you know, and yes, I did. But you're not saying anything because it's so terrible to confess that. Anyway, he spanked me. And my reaction to that was, he loved me because he was doing what he said he was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was wrong.
Sure.
And it wasn't like, oh, how mean, you know, you shouldn't be spanking me. I somehow, at a gut level, I interpreted that as love. And I know as we read the second half, not even half, it's like he gives you about 13 verses of here's how good it's going to go. Then he gives you about 50 verses of if you don't.
Because
he knows they're not going to
bomb you.
He knows they're not going to. Anyway, there's a way in which you could read that and go, man, that's one mean guy. But it's actually love. He will pursue them with discipline. If his words of comfort don't work, he'll discipline them. He wants them back. So he's going to spank them.
Well, and to put it in that familial range you're talking about, Bob, you know, I have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
I would absolutely, at the minimum, handle it this way. At the minimum.
Yeah.
And here's God talking to us and saying, all right, brother, you know, you believe
Son.
Me?
Son,
better word,
yeah.
Absolute better word. All right, son. If we are gonna go on this journey,
yeah.
And here's how it's gonna go, and I think Bob, the hard part for our listeners and people that they talk to is when you read this text that we've just read. It's very rule-oriented, and man today does not
rules. I wouldn't have those. That's not the label I would put on it. It's discipline.
Sure.
And he says in the middle of that, you know, the day you turn back to me,
mm-hmm.
we're all good again.
It's all good.
But you walk away from me, here's what I'm going to do to get you back. It's discipline, and there is a heavy, my point is there's a heavy love component in discipline
mm-hmm.
that human beings recognize at a primal level. I'm not saying that can't be abused. I mean, that's terribly abused by humans, you know, that over-discipline their children and stuff like that, taking out their own anger on their kids. This isn't God taking out his own anger. This is God going, if you turn away from me, the only thing that could possibly await you is destruction.
I won't help you.
Yeah, so I will discipline you to get you back.
Well, and if we look, and again, I don't want to get off on this rabbit trail too far, Bob, but if you look at our culture today, our culture doesn't like to be disciplined at all.
No.
And I know, you know, from my own personal experience, when I talk to people about the Bible, that's one of the major problems is this obedience part. and, you know, that we are talking about right now. God is not saying you have to be obedient or, but he is saying you have to be obedient or.
Yeah, I see, I don't even think in terms of obedience that often. Obedience is not a wrong concept to describe what we're talking about, but it's not the deepest concept. For me, it's a relationship. And God is saying, honor the relationship or I'll make you honor it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you honor it freely, it's life-giving. That's how I read it.
Well, and Bob, when you say honor, that's really putting it in the proper structure.
Yeah.
You know, who's first, who's second, who's third? You know, yeah. What is that structure?
Well, let's say it
like
this. I don't think of it as, am I going to obey God or disobey in this instance? I think of it as, am I going to walk with him or am I going to walk away from him? And walking away from God makes zero sense. That's
right.
How I think of it. Not as obedience, but as relationship.
So as we look at the text that we just read, God pretty well laid it out that he will
do these things.
Yeah.
And he did them exactly, as you read, you know, what our readers know is coming up in the following books of the Bible. They're going to do this exactly.
Yep.
They're going to walk away from him. And he's going to do this step by step.
So then, Bob, how do you, and I'm going to use the word combat, how do you combat it when somebody pulls this type of text and says, oh, your God is so mean. Because of our obedience, you know, as we're out there and we're sharing the word and we're talking about this, this is the kind of text that people have problems with. You know, people, and when I say people, I say, the world at large, they hear something like this and they go, oh, all right, Bob, I can't be into that. Your God is going to punish me
for everything.
You
know, I guess I just try to bring it back to what we instinctually know. And let me diffuse, like we talked about on our last podcast, your passion with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I don't think there's a person out there who has children that doesn't act exactly like this chapter. I mean, you tell little Susie to be home at 8:30 and she doesn't come home till 10:30. What do you do?
Big problem.
Here's your ice cream. Have a nice night.
Yeah.
You don't do that.
No.
There's no parent that does
that. Nor do our listeners, Bob. I know that.
That's what I mean. And so if you're not doing it, why is that? That's actually because you love little Susie, and there's a reason you told her to be in at 8:30. Yeah, nothing good is going to happen after 8:30 for Susie at that age.
Right.
Okay, so you're protecting her. You're saying, here's how life works. You need to walk within these boundaries. And if she doesn't, you discipline her to get her back in there. Because the way she's going will only lead to destruction. Every parent I know does that. So then why would you criticize the Lord for doing that?
Well, and that is my question. And, you know, as we talk to people, we have to be cognizant of that. That is where they're coming from. But I think, Bob, the good news that we get out of a reading like this, most people will just focus I'm going to get spanked. But they don't read the rest of it where it says, but if you do that, here's what I'm going to do for you.
Yeah, and I think you're partially correct. I also think that plenty of readers, in fact, the vast majority, will read a section like that and conclude, I better get it together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Don't mess with me. It's going to go bad for you if you don't do what I'm saying.
Well, and he comes in and he says, and I'm here. I'm with you. I will make your
And think of this, you know, explicit. That's right. And so explicit, let's consider that. So on the seventh year, don't farm.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, the nation, I'm going to say that in general terms. See, we're talking about 1 million people, 999,000 of them go out there and farm that year. What are they actually saying to God?
I don't believe you.
Yeah, like, I don't think you're actually going to do what you... You got to be kidding me. The guy that freed you from Egypt, that has that much power, that created the universe by speaking, you don't think he can make your crops produce that year? See, you're saying no to him. And on what basis? Why would anyone ever say no to God? And the reason is, and he mentioned it in that text. So imagine, sometimes it takes me a while to look through these texts, but imagine verse 19 again of chapter 26. Let's start in 18. If also after these things you do not obey me, like after round one, you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride of power. And that's, he just stated the fundamental issue. You know, why would you not believe me when I'm telling you on the seventh year I will do this? On the sixth year I'll make so much come in that you'll have 3 years worth. Why would you not believe me? Because you're proud.
Pride of power. I think that's, I mean, that's a key phrase, Bob, because if we think about our culture today, how important is power? If you're a manager,
yeah, that mankind, you know, is going to figure out the solution to all his issues. Just quickly for all of our listeners, if you're trusting in the American government, whatever quote side of the aisle you're on, if you think the Republicans are going to solve all our issues, or if you think the Democrats are going to solve all our issues, you need to wake up. They will not and cannot do that.
Nope.
And the only person that's going to ultimately solve all our issues is God. But yep, we think we're going to solve them all. We'll figure out how to water our crops, whether there's rain or not. We'll figure out how to do all these things. And meanwhile, our society's headed for disaster. I don't even want to list all of them.
Take it a little bit further, Bob. We'll figure out how to punish everybody. Our systems won't be perfect.
We will not.
We won't.
We are limited. We are God's creation. We're his image. So there aren't many limits, but we are not him. And he's the only guy who has the perfect plan. Pride's the problem. Pride is the issue. So humble yourself and listen to God. Don't listen to the leanings of your own heart. Submit your heart to his.
Well, and that's really what I'm hearing in you know, this particular episode, Bob, is pride is a big problem. And for our listeners, it's the fundamental issue. Yeah, I'll share with our listeners my own personal story. I used to be that same prideful person, Bob. I used to think that everything that was created came out of me and gave no glory to God. None whatsoever. It's that prideful person it squelches everything else. Nothing else means anything.
You know, another example of that, Jamie, is the statistics on people who come to faith and their age, at their time of coming. What I mean by that is, at least in Western culture, the overwhelmingly majority of people come to faith in their infancy, when they're children. They come through their parents, because they listen to their parents, basically. I know we all tend to think our kids are little devils running around, but basically they listen to you. And you take them to church, they hear the message. To a kid, that all makes perfect sense.
Sure.
Okay, by the time you're in your 20s, you know, you're out of the nest and so on, just rounding off the figures, you already feel like you have it figured out. And you're not even close. So you didn't grow up inside the household of faith. And so now you're out there and you think you know what's going on, and someone tells you the gospel and you're like, no way. Right? And that's all due to pride. You think you have it figured out. and you don't. So pride is the death blow of all of us, and that ultimately comes from the devil. It's the deepest cut in the cosmic battle. I'll never escape. Hey, I want to refer to this on the podcast. I often do in church, you know, but my own family growing up, and the family I grew up in, my dad was a doctor, a very accomplished guy, and my mom was in a sense, the opposite. She was this fun-loving, beautiful creature that was a singer, had an album and all that, you know, so we had rock music just blaring in our house all the time. It's hard for me not to think of music and famous rock and roll stuff that was current when I was a kid growing up. But when I said, you know, the deepest cut is pride, you know, I'm thinking of Cat Stevens and Rod Stewart singing "The First Cut is the Deepest." Mm-hmm. And it's that pride issue. You know, that's what the devil was tempting Eve with. You know, hey, God's jealous of that fruit. He's guarding it because he knows when you do that, you'll be like him. And he's appealing to her pride, you know, to be God. And that's in all of us now. That first cut went to our soul. And now that's what we're going to struggle with from here on out. We think that we're God.
Well, and what God, what God is putting down here, Bob, that I see is he's really laying the parameters. And, you know, you shared a really great analogy with me 4 years ago. And I don't think we've shared this on our podcast, but I think this is a good point to talk about it. And the analogy that you gave me was, you asked me a simple question. You said, "Jamie, where does the power from a river come from?" And I thought about it. You know, I consider myself halfway smart.
Yeah, and we got a good river right outside the window, right? The Eagle River, which becomes the Colorado about 5 miles down the road.
So pretty powerful river. Great example.
Especially in the spring.
And so my initial answer was the water. And you said, "All right, well, sure, you think that the water gives it its power, but where does the power really come from? It comes from the banks, because without the banks, the water would just dissipate, spread out, and
dry
it's useless.
Up and it's gone." That's right.
And that's really kind of what we're hearing right here, is here's the banks, and that is what's going to give us the power. Yeah. If you believe in me, I'll show up. If you don't believe in me, it's going to be worse and I won't show up.
Yeah, I appreciate you referring to that analogy in its original context, and it applies in the way that I'll state here momentarily, but it's an analogy of the coexistence and the inextricability of love and truth.
Mm-hmm.
Very few human beings that I know will be repelled by the concept of love. Almost all of them will be drawn by that.
Sure.
But love is inseparably bound to truth. There is no such thing as love without truth. And so our analogy, you got that water, and that, oh yeah, man, that water, you can hear it all the way from our house. It's just a rumble.
Raging.
You know, it's just resonates with power. Well, that's because it's controlled by the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Love, if it's not controlled by truth, is a puddle that dries up and goes away at the rising of the sun. Love, as it is controlled by truth, is a powerful force that can change the universe. So the words of God are the truth that channels the power of his love. And that's what we're really reading here in these passages.
It really is. I see exactly, you know, when we were reading this, Bob, I saw the visual that you gave me with that analogy about the river. And, you know, without the parameters, there is no power.
No.
And so it really feels to me like what God is saying right now is here's the parameters. You know, if you live within the parameters, we are so good it's not even funny.
That's right. Yeah, we are so powerful. We change the universe. Yeah.
But bro, if you live outside of those parameters.
Yeah. So there we are. Okay. So with that little pick me up.
Yeah, dried up and be destroyed by the sun. I think that's where we left.
All right. Let's finish the book of Leviticus.
Amen.
Let's read chapter 27. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is of the male from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it's a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. If it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels and for the female 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even up to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. If they are from 60 years old and upward, if it's a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if he's poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him. According to the means of the one who vowed, the priest shall value him. Now, if it's an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering to the Lord, any such that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. He shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad, or a bad for a good. Or if he does exchange animal for animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. If, however, it is any unclean animal of any kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest. The priest shall value it as either good or bad, as you, the priest, value it, so it shall be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, then he shall add 1/5 to your valuation." Okay, let's pause for a sec.
Yeah, we way got to pause.
We can read the whole chapter, but I can see your brows are is furrowed. Yeah. You got this big crease above your nose.
I don't get this, Bob. What? You know, I used to own a mortgage company, so I understand finances. I don't get this.
That's a distant application of this.
Very. I get that, but I don't understand what he's saying here. And you know, I know for our listeners that when we read this chapter, we look at it and go, okay, am I worth more than a female?
Let me put some shoe leather on it. Right. And we'll get to the male-female thing in a second. But your current business is beginning to prosper. Are you already thinking about what you're going to do for God?
Yes.
And not even for him, but like with him, right?
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
That's what this chapter's talking about.
I absolutely am. And just to carry that on, Bob, you know, I look at, you know, and I again, speaking to our listeners, if you're a business owner, I hope, and let me rephrase this, my prayer for you is that you understand that God is in control of your business.
Yeah, that you're a steward.
Yes.
That's right.
And that your stewardship is hopefully with the wisdom of Solomon. And I know we're moving way forward by saying that. But that is really what I hope for in my business.
Well, let's bring it down to an even more basic level. Once somebody begins to catch the drift of what's going on with the Bible, who God is, who they are, and your eyes, you know, metaphorically just open wide up.
Wide open.
You realize this is everything and that you want to dedicate stuff to God because you now realize that I'm the steward. This is, I'm going to live forever. I'm going to have everything in the future. And so you want to do stuff for him. He's very concerned about your promises. So, you know, it's the word vow that we translate into the English text. Right? So we're reading, if your vows... So you have people going, I just want to serve God. I'm going to offer myself to the temple. Well, what's that worth monetarily? Well, it's 15 shekels according to the shekel. You know, it's a standard monetary valuation. That's worth 15 shekels. If you're over 60, it's worth this. If you're under... The difference between... Let me jump ahead just for a second to the next question. Between a guy and a girl, you know, just to use street language, is, remember, this is an agrarian culture.
So
they're laborers. They're physical laborers. Okay, what is, in the year 2012 in gypsum, what's my wife worth compared to me as a wage earner? About 100 to 1.
Right.
Okay.
Right, sure.
My wife can sell a chair, or go redesign your house, and get paid well for that. I can go to work and make an hourly wage, right? So our culture is different. But if we're farming, how much grass can I mow if it's not with a mower that you're sitting, you know, by hand with a sickle compared to Kathy? About twice. I would be confident saying that. I can do twice the physical work she can do in a situation like that. So that's why the valuations are different. That's labor. That's not inherent worth of a person. That's not guys are more important than girls. Don't ever forget the earliest chapters of the Bible where God says male and female, he made them the image of God. They're equivalent. There's no sexual distinction as far as that goes. There's, in an agrarian society, males can work harder. They're bigger and stronger.
Well, and if you think about it, Bob, you know, what we're really talking about is evaluation, not being on the business, but on the people. Am I?
Yeah, and they're vowing service to the temple, to the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
And Moses is just laying out, here's what that's worth. If you want to keep a tally of that, you know, you dedicate your son, you sell him into service for the temple, he's worth X. Your daughter's worth X minus whatever.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with their standing in front of God. It's an agrarian work culture. Here's another example. You know, today in basketball, Brittany Griner, the center for the Baylor Bears, she's like 6'8", something
she's
like that.
Rocking.
She dominates, right? Let me tell you how Brittany's going to do in the NBA. She would not even qualify for a team. She couldn't even play point guard at
6'8".
Yeah, I mean, those guys are twice as fast. They're going to jump twice as high. Brittany weighs, you know, whatever, at 6'8". Maybe she weighs 200, 190. And she's skinny as a rail. Might not even weigh that. A 6'8 guy in the NBA weighs about 220, and it's all muscle. They're different creatures.
Well, and I think, Bob, you know, understanding that, but what we really need to get out here is again, the covenant, the promise that God's making to us. And I know you and I have talked about this, but if God lies, where are we all at?
We're dead.
Yeah. And so understanding that God tells the truth, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember also my covenant with Isaac. And I'm reading from chapter 26, verse 42. My covenant with Abraham as well, I will remember the land.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, not only the people blessing, but the land blessing. You know, which we talked about this morning with Chronicles, how important Jerusalem is,
yep.
The land.
That's right.
The land itself is very important, and he is making a promise to us.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't want to get too far away from the point of this chapter is talking about vows to God.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's how to categorize it. Here's the valuation of these certain vows.
Right.
And it's important because, you know, as we're going to see as we finish out this text, you break that vow. Ooh. That, you know, that's not like me saying to you, Jamie, the Cleveland Browns are going to win the Super Bowl this year, and then they don't win. Okay, you're like, I knew they weren't gonna. But if I say, God, I am going to do this with what you give me, and then you don't do that, ooh, you gotta be really careful with what you say to him. And there's an underlying reason for that, and that is because his word is inviolate, and we're his image. So he expects us, when you make a vow or a pledge, you got to follow through on that because you're his image.
Right.
That's the fundamental issue that's going on. So let's continue on in the text, verse 14. Now if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord. So me and my family are going to serve God the rest of our days. The father of the family decides that, right? Then, okay, here's what follows. Then the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. Yet, if the one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add 1/5 of your valuation price to it, so that it may be this, his. So, in other words, okay, my whole family is going to serve God, and 2 years into it, you're like, This isn't working out. I need to, okay.
Buy out.
Yeah, I got to buy out. Okay, then you got to add 1/5 to it and then buy out because you broke your word. But okay, we'll let you pony up and buy out of it. Verse 16. Again, if a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it. A homer of barley seed, 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. Right, let's pause there for same rules, right?
Right.
Jubilee, everybody goes free. I mean, you're always mine, but your vow only lasts this long. Then you're set free. You want to re-up? I'll re-up with you after 50 years. But at this point, we renegotiate.
And really, that same man has no onus to man past a certain point. Is that really what it's saying?
It's just saying, it's hearkening back to the principles of the previous chapters that no one is a, you guys are all mine, you're my family, but no one's in debt perpetually.
Gotcha.
Even when you vow yourself to me, I'm going to release you from that according to the year of Jubilee, and then you re-up if you want. We may have a great relationship and you may want to do it again. That's great. But we're going to reevaluate after this much time. So, verse 19. If the one who consecrates it should ever wish to redeem the field, then he shall add 1/5 of your valuation price to it, so that it may pass to him. So you want to do it earlier than the year of Jubilee? Okay, but it's going to cost you 20%.
Yep.
To re-up.
Re-up.
To buy out. To re-up. Okay, verse 20. Yet, if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts in the Jubilee, the field shall be holy to the Lord, like a field set apart. It shall be for the priest as his property. Or if he consecrates to the Lord a field which he has bought, which is not part of the field of his own property, then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of your valuation up to the year of Jubilee, and he shall on that day give your valuation as holy to the Lord. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to the one from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs. This is all just standard units of measurement. But the issue that was going on there is, say I own some of your land. You got in financial hardship and I bailed you out, but as a consequence, I own some of your land. Then I go, you know, I'm going to dedicate that part to God. I don't really need it. Well, I can do that up until the year of Jubilee, and then that goes back to you. Because you cannot be perpetually in debt. That's what they're talking about there. Verse 26. However, a firstborn among animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may consecrate it, whether ox or sheep, it's the Lord's. So here's the deal. So remember an earlier principle of Leviticus, the firstborn belongs to him. Mm-hmm. Well, then you can't give him what's already his.
Right.
You can't say, I'm going to dedicate my firstborn to you.
Well, that's mine.
It's already mine.
Right.
So it's not unlike your conversation at golf today with Randall.
Right.
Yeah, hey, Randall, how come you don't come to church? Well, you know what, Jamie, really, that's kind of my day. And your dad, father-in-law, goes, you know what, Randall, that's actually God's day.
Pick
so you can't dedicate that one to yourself. God already owns that one.
Pick another
one. That's what they're saying there.
Gotcha.
So verse 27, but if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it. So that unclean ones don't belong to God. So you want to give a donkey or a, you know, something like that. Then he shall redeem it according to your valuation and add to it 1/5 of it. And if it's not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuation. So they're just talking about market rules for what costs what during these transactions. Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has, of man or animal, or of the fields of his own property, he shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. No one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Okay, so let me clarify that past section, because as you're listening along, your mind already, you know, with a number of passages all going in the same direction, your mind kind of preconceives what's going to come next. And then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, 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 what? Wait, read that again? What were you talking about? Well, there were certain things in their culture that were banned or dedicated to destruction. You have an example of that, like in Joshua chapter 7, where Achan steals the stuff that they were supposed to destroy and tries to hide it and so on. Well, you can't say Achan, you know, for those of us, those of the listeners not following this, go read that chapter and you can see what happened. But you can't have a pot of gold, so to speak, that you got illicitly and it was discovered, and then you can't say, you know what, I'm going to give that to God. No, that's dedicated for destruction. You can't, like,
gotcha,
indenture yourself to God's service to escape a penalty from the culture. That's
gotcha.
What he's saying.
Gotcha.
So
very clear when you put it that way, Bob.
Okay, verse 28. Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has, of man or animal, or of the fields of his own property, shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. Like, okay, that should be destroyed. Don't try to use that as a bargaining chip. Verse 29, no one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Like the guy, remember last podcast, the blasphemer guy? Okay, we're going to stone him. He can't go, you know what, just sell me into the service of the tabernacle. I'll serve the No. You're dedicated for destruction because of what you
did. Gotcha.
Verse 30. Thus all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the tree is the Lord's. It's holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add to it 1/5 to it. So you want to rethink.
Tithe plus 20.
Yeah, you want to rethink what you did. All right, 20% more. For every tenth part of the herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. Passing under the rod here, I think, is just they're counting them. They're tapping mm-hmm. them on the back. One, two, three, four. Every tenth one goes over to God. Right. That's actually, well, I'm going to finish this these couple verses so we can finish Leviticus, and then I'll describe a different application of that. Verse 33, he is not to be concerned whether it's good or bad, nor shall he exchange it, you know, like, oh, I'm going to give God the crippled one or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. So that's the summary of the entire book. Here's the deal. God's been up on the mountain talking to, or Moses has been up on the mountain talking to God face to face. That's why Leviticus is such an interesting book. I know there's things like this chapter and a few chapters previous that you're just shaking your head going, you know, I don't understand that. That's because we're 3,500 years removed. But remember, this book is unique in all the 66 books of the Bible in that it is primarily just quotes from God telling Moses, here's how I want it done. Very interesting. What I was going to say about the 10th was we have a word in our culture that we often don't recognize its origin, but decimate is from that exact same concept.
Really?
Well, deca in Latin's every tenth. So in the Roman army, and Caesar had this done at one or two points in his career, when the army, you know, goofs up. And that goofs up is a stupid word to use for this, but, you know, so it rebels against the commander. And things have been settled one way or another, and now in the aftermath of the conflict, you got the army lined up and the commander staring at him like, you didn't do what I said. Okay, I'm going to decimate you guys. So line up, every tenth guy gets killed. That's what the word decimate originally meant. And you can see, man, if I was in there, I'd be counting like minutes before that guy got there. Like, what number am I? I do not want to be number 10.
Yeah, I'd be switching.
Hey, Joe, your shoe's untied, you know, get in front of him. But so it very much like the tithe in Israel, decimate in the Roman army was the same thing, except every tenth was destroyed.
And really what we've talked about, Bob, is really one of the hardest concepts, I think, for Christians to get their, true Christians, to get their head around: obedience.
Well, why is that hard? Why do you keep bringing that up? I'm not saying that to contest you. I'm just saying,
it is.
Why do we perceive it so differently?
It is. You think about obedience in the world. People don't want to obey anything but their own personal desires.
Okay, so let me address that. Thank you, Ben, for bringing that up again to continue to flesh that out. Because as you were saying that, you know, I'm picturing myself at work, and I answer to John, who's been on our podcast, and then I answer to engineering, and then ultimately I answer to our general manager, and I have to confess, I don't really feel like I answer to those guys.
Mm-hmm.
No, if I did such and such, it's because that's what I decided to do. Who are
right.
you guys to tell
right.
me? Now, we have policies and procedures, and I read through that and go, okay, this is how we accomplish this goal. I mean, I understand that. But who's my boss? I mean, I feel like God's my boss. And these guys, I don't give the right to anybody to tell me what to do. I mean, I want to follow the policies. But that's kind of interesting that you raise that, because I feel the human fallen nature of, hey, nobody really tells me what to do. I'll tell myself what to do.
Period.
With God, I don't feel that. I feel that on an earthly plane. I'll tell you, we could line up a list that would extend out that door over there 30 feet away of people who have conflicted with me over this and go, man, that guy's the worst. He ain't going to listen to anything you say. He's so high and mighty. You know, he's his own guy. You would have a list like that mm-hmm. of people saying, Bob doesn't listen to anybody.
I know I would.
And that's to my discredit, actually. But I understand what you're saying. I just don't see God that way because I do not picture him as my equal.
Well, and
he's
I'm
my
not.
Creator. I mean, this is the guy that knit me together in my mother's womb.
Well, and I'm not saying God, Bob. I'm saying humanity. Humanity has the challenge with that authority structure. Not just you or I, we understand it, but humanity as a whole.
But if you paint, I understand, and your point's well taken, mm-hmm. but what you're describing is, in our books, I'm going to round off 2,000 pages long. You're describing the issue that's underneath all 2,000 pages.
Sure.
In the book of Leviticus, that issue underlies everything, but there's another level at which to view that we have portrayed the picture to our listeners in this way. This is Dad who's coming to live with us again, saying, here's how we get along in my house. You guys are mine. This is my family. Here's how we do it. Particularly given the fact that I'm holy and you're not. So here's how we get along. When you approach me, do it this way. Here's the rules. All I see is protection from his holiness. When you describe passages like, oh, you know, he seems kind of mean here, I don't see it as mean. I see it as he's holy. I mean, what he's describing is things that will kill you if you don't take account of them in your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it. I understand the burr that's in your saddle, but we're going to have to scratch that one every page of the book.
Well, and Bob, it's not a burr in my saddle, but I know after, you know, being out sharing the word in the world, that's what people say. You know, and for our listeners, you know, maybe you're one of those guys that is thinking it that way. You know, thinking about the word that way, that, oh, God is just a God of rules, and if I don't meet his rules, I'll never meet his expectations. And that's not what he's saying here.
Yeah.
He is, but he isn't. You see what I'm saying?
Let me address it this way. Let me take a different tact, since you're continuing to pick out this burr from your saddle.
I am.
That you keep saying it's not your burr.
It's not my burr, but
I'm suspecting
there.
It might
it's
be.
It's there.
To me, another way to look at this, let's use another metaphor. Have you ever seen one of those things? I haven't seen them as an adult very often, but as a kid growing up, and I'm 53 years old, so for our listeners, so you can gauge what I'm saying. Some people, I always thought it was sort of weird, but they had like this little thing that was about 3 inches in diameter, and it was cone-shaped, round, a dome-shaped thing, and it was like a winter scene. And there's liquid inside this container, and there's like a tree and some little kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you shook it up, what represented snow would fill the whole container. And then slowly the snow would settle to the ground. If you, from outside, looking into that thing, that seemed ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would anybody pay money to buy one of these things? You know, what's it do? What is it? All these kind of questions that you would have from outside. Imagine if I was inside that environment. Then all that stuff would be radically important to me.
Well, yeah, so, here it comes, it's snowing again.
So, in other words, the itch that you're scratching really boils down to this. If you're a listener and you're outside the household of faith, that is, you're outside the bubble and trying to look in and make sense of this, some of that is going to be questionable. Mm-hmm. You're not going to understand that.
Not in one setting.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's not irrational, but it's not going to penetrate you from inside that bubble, inside the household of faith. To me, it makes perfect sense. That's how I would describe it, what you're bringing up.
Well, and I hope our listeners appreciate that, Bob, you know, because it's a thought process that was very ingrained in my person until I came to faith.
Yeah. Well, we all bring our baggage and stuff. You know, in some ways, it's not, this is a little bit of a distant analogy, but when you go over to somebody else's house and you notice how they interact with their children and what their household rules are, it's not infrequent that you're kind of inside, you're shaking your head like,
right. Oh, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. That's not right. It's not your house.
Right.
So keep your mouth shut and go back to your house and do it the way you do it in your house.
Right.
Okay? So inside God's household, this is how he does it.
Gotcha.
So outside of that, just keep your mouth shut and observe what God is doing here. And outside of our analogy, the way it's going to work out is, you know what? Maybe you ought to think about how God runs his household.
Well, and really, you know, for closing point, our listeners should really, you know, think about how they're relating to God.
That's right.
You know, are you relating to him, or are you pigeonholing him?
Here's how I want our listeners to relate to God, in the true sense of this word, sincerely. In honesty. If you got an issue, put it out there. That's how I want people to relate to God, in truth and love. So let's say a prayer. Lord, we've finished the book of Leviticus. We separate your word into books. And I know that you understand those divisions, for you once took on human flesh for all time. Subsequently, Jesus, who's eternal, the I Am, added human flesh to his person. And when he referred back to these words, he made the same kinds of divisions that we're making. But we finished this section, and we, in our own naive and immature way, call this how to live with Dad and Dad's household. Impart your words to us. Press them upon our heart. Shower your love and compassion on us. Hide your wrath. May we respond to you as a loving child. In Jesus' name,
amen.